Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how fasting and probiotics together can help prevent diabetes. Then we're going to explore how blueberries in the diet are linked with lower breast cancer risk. That's from Massey University in New Zealand. We're also going to talk about how yoga and meditation can minimize cognitive impairment from UCLA. And from Anglia Ruskin University in the United Kingdom, junk food causes similar high blood sugar levels as type 2 diabetes. And maple syrup is a cancer killer. Yeah, kills cancer cells. Who knew? Now we do. And that was published in Oncology Reports. Also, for those who have asked, why have not more black leaders come forward and told the truth about the Clinton legacy to the black and brown communities? So, for example, what her husband and she did, remember they were co-presidents with the destruction of the welfare system. That was the only safety net for millions of people. And how about three strikes you're out? And how about the putting into more laws to get more people in jail for longer periods of time? That was her husband. He was more right than any of the neocons at that time. Well, we have a couple voices that are going to speak out today. Also, the whole idea that we should have a war on drugs is just, it's foolish. It's immature. We should not. We should look at the war on drugs as one of the worst programs in American history. I'm going to give you two perspectives. One is a longer perspective from Rolling Stone, from an article by Tim Dickinson. I'm only going to give you two pages of it, and you can read the rest. But also Russell Brand, a former drug addict, gave a very short but very compelling and articulate, insightful, and straight-on comment before a group in England, a committee, about why not use altruism, compassion, and pragmatism when dealing with drugs instead of just laws that lock them up and punish them. And also protecting Social Security. Most people don't realize that Social Security is not an entitlement. The government, not the federal government, not the state government, not the local government, puts a penny into Social Security fund. We do. The employer and the employee both put money into the Social Security, and it's there. So when the day comes when we retire and need that money, it's ours. It's ours for the latter part of our lives to help us. So why is it that the federal government comes along and keeps borrowing money from it? It's not theirs. And yet they do that. And they recently did it again. So I have Senator Ron Paul challenged it, and I thought he was rather articulate on this particular issue, on this subject. So I'm going to share that with you. We always start with health and nutrition because that's a universal need. We all need to be healthier, to live a longer life without suffering. Now, according to the University of Auckland, if you were to restrict the dense carbohydrates and the sugars in your diet, and at the same time, provide yourself with some healthy probiotics. Now, the best probiotics are to get those that are measured by the billions in any good product. I would suggest we need between 4 to 8 billion a day under normal circumstances. And that means that those billions of good bacteria are creating wonderful health in our intestine, which then is sharing that health and information with other cells in our body. So we're all working in harmony for health. So what would be the easiest way? Well, the easiest would be to get yourself a non-dairy, let's say like a coconut yogurt or a rice milk yogurt. That's a good way. But you're not getting a lot. All right, you're getting in the millions, not hundreds of millions, certainly not billions. Another way would be to have some fermented food, like a miso soup. Well, that's great, and that's a really good amount. And sauerkraut is outstanding. And you can get low-sodium sauerkraut as well. But also understand that when you ferment any of these foods, including fermenting beets, fermenting carrots, fermenting cabbage, fermenting turnips, fermenting cucumbers, you're able to get the probiotics because that's part of the whole germination process. So get them into your system on a daily basis. Now, when you do that, when you get rid of the high-density carbohydrates, the sugary drinks, and the sugary desserts, you make an enormous improvement in preventing diabetes. And diabetes right now is a scourge. It exceeds heart disease in the number of people suffering. In fact, half of all adults in the United States today are pre-diabetic or diabetic. From Massey University in New Zealand, they found that blueberries in the diet can lower breast cancer risk. Well, that's good. And this was because they believe, quote, blueberries contain phytochemicals, those are natural occurring chemicals in the fruit or vegetable, called anthocyanins, which may be responsible for the health benefits of blueberries. They reduce free radicals in our system. That's good. That traps those dangerous free radicals and prevents them from causing massive damage to our DNA. And they decrease new blood vessel formation and increase the number of beneficial bacteria, all elements which help to fight against breast cancer. And so, quote, we also found circulating estrogen, the steroid hormone which plays a key role in breast cancer promotion, was lower in those that consumed the blueberry supplement. How about that? Where do you get lots of estrogen, which can contribute to prostate cancer, uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, and breast cancer? Meat. Yeah, meat, the high-protein diets, stress, and being overweight. Just having fat on your body produces more estrogen. So by being lean, vegan, you're going to prevent more breast cancer and prostate cancer. But now add in blueberries, and that's a big deal. Quote, we were able to say blueberry consumption may lower the risk of developing breast cancer. Also, for those of you who are looking for a way to improve your cognition and not lose it, because, wow, be around anyone who is no longer cognitive. They won't know what day it is. I recently went to an art exhibit for a very close friend of mine, and he was sitting there, and I went over and I said, how's it going? Oh, it's so good to see you. I'm glad you came. And we were sitting there, and there were hundreds of people in the gallery, and five times in 20 minutes, he turned to me and said, where are we at? And I told him where he was at. He said, okay. Then a couple minutes later, where are we at? That's the loss of cognition. And it happens, and then you start thinking, oh my goodness, where does it go from here? It all goes downhill. Because then they'll start to forget basic things like, did you shampoo? I don't remember. Did you shower? I don't remember. They'll forget basic things, things that you and I take for granted. Then they'll start forgetting what they read, what they watched, what they heard, and then they forget names. And then with their caregivers and family, those who are closest to them, they'll recognize them to a point, and then one day they don't. So it's so important that you realize how serious it is, and we are not at an epidemic level, we are at a pandemic level. We now are facing a tsunami of tens of millions of Americans suffering from different forms of memory loss and cognitive impairment and dementia and Alzheimer's. Now, right now as I speak, and it's only going to get worse. And if you don't think it disrupts your life, why don't you be one of the family members who has to take care of mom or dad? And in one case, I recently counseled someone, mom and dad, First it was mom and then it was dad. And when it happens fast. Anyhow, what they found was that yoga and meditation can minimize cognitive impairment. Look at it as inner peace. Inner peace in a flexible body. That's when you have meditation and yoga together. There are tremendous benefits. And a team found that a 3-month course of yoga and meditation practice helped minimize cognitive and emotional problems that often precede Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. So you want to keep that memory as long as possible. And the research was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Also, junk food causes similar high blood sugar levels as diabetes, type 2 diabetes. This is some new research published in Experimental Physiology from the Anglia Ruskin University in the United Kingdom. Now, we know that type 2 diabetes is often associated with obesity, and a number of cases are rising worldwide at an alarming rate. And in type 2 diabetes, the body does not always produce enough insulin or doesn't react to it. And this is causing an accumulation of sugar, which is glucose in your blood, which can have severe long-term consequences for your kidneys, for your heart, for your eyes. And it can lead directly to kidney disease. And hence, finding a way to block glucose reabsorption in the kidneys could offer potential treatment for lowering blood sugar levels. And in this study, researchers found that you have a diet that's high in sugars and refined carbohydrate that leads to obesity, and that leads also to insulin resistance. And that's terrible. And it took as little as eating, you know, buns and cheese and junk food. It took as little as 8 weeks to end up having a disease similar to diabetes and adversely affecting glucose transporters in the kidneys. It doesn't take long. 2 months of eating junk food and you're there. And finally, maple syrup is a cancer killer. That's new research. I haven't seen it anywhere else. So it's good. And the study was published in Oncology Reports and reveals that maple syrup inhibits the growth and invasion of human colorectal cancer cells. And that's terrific. So just keep that in mind. And there's a lot of potent benefit to it. Quote from the study, inhibitory effect of maple syrup on cell growth and invasion of human colorectal cancer cells. And it was performed by Japanese researchers. And they looked at the color and of the maple syrup and the grade, and they looked at all of them worked on colorectal cancer. So another thing that can help people, and that's what we like to do. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world. Thank you for listening today, and please always pass on the information. I'm going to quote just 2 pages from Rolling Stone, the current issue, Jim Dickinson, an article entitled Why America Can't Quit the Drug War. For 45 years, quote, more than $1 trillion wasted in the creation of the world's largest prison system, America still lacks the political will to change its failed drug policy. In March, the commander-in-chief of the War on Drugs stood in front of the crowd of policymakers, advocates, and recovering addicts to declare that America has been doing it wrong. Speaking at the National Prescription Drug Abuse and Heroin Summit in Atlanta, focused on an overdose epidemic now killing some 30,000 Americans a year, President Barack Obama declared, quote, for too long, we have viewed the problem of drug abuse through the lens of the criminal justice system, creating grave cost. We end up with jails full of folks who can't function when they get out, and we end up with people's lives being shattered, end quote. While touting a plan to increase drug treatment spending by more than $1 billion, the capstone to the administration's efforts to double the federal drug treatment budget. Obama insisted, quote, "This is a straightforward proposition. How do you save lives once people are addicted so that they have a chance to recover?" Obama's speech underscored tactical and rhetorical shifts in the prosecution of the war on drugs, the first durable course correction in this failed 45-year war. The administration has enshrined three crucial policy reforms. First, health insurers must now cover drug treatment as a requirement of Obamacare. Second, draconian drug sentences have been scaled back and helping to reduce the number of federal drug prisoners by more than 15%. Third, over the screams of prohibitionists in its ranks, the White House is allowing marijuana's march out of the black market, with legalization expected to reach California and beyond in November. The administration's change in rhetoric has been even more sweeping. Responding to opiate deaths, Obama appointed a new drug czar who previously ran point on drug treatment in Massachusetts. And the Botticelli, the man's comment, quote, "failed policies and failed practices," and refers not to heroin junkies or addicts, but Americans with opiate abuse disorders. Despite strides towards a more sane national drug policy, the deeper infrastructure of the war on drugs remains fundamentally unaltered under Obama. Work focused on public health has not replaced parliamentary anti-trafficking efforts, known as interdiction, at home or abroad. Rather, much like an all-of-the-above energy strategy that embraces solar while continuing to remove mountaintops in pursuit of coal, the policies supplement the old. As a result, the drug war is costing taxpayers more than ever. In fact, this year it's $31 billion. All right, that's just a page and a half. Now, we're going to play you a clip from Russell Brand, the comedian, and who is an acknowledged drug user and had been addicted. And here's what he has to say about helping people with drugs by not criminalizing them.
Currently working on a program about addiction and how it's viewed in society. What messages are you hoping to get across in that program?
The messages that we're hoping to get across in this program is that maintenance of drug addiction through state-sponsored substances like methadone should only be deployed as part of a reduction with the ultimate aim of abstinence-based recovery. That we need to start regarding addiction in all its forms as a health issue as opposed to a judicial and criminal issue. That we need to change the laws in this country, and we need to have a more compassionate, altruistic, loving attitude to the people with a disease of addiction, and recognise that these people, with the proper help, access to the proper treatment, can become active and helpful members of society, like myself, some would argue that point, or perhaps more obviously Chip Summers, who, a man with a criminal record as long as your arm, now runs a treatment centre and has been like clean for 27 years. That's the message, that we don't want to discard people, we don't want to life them off on methadone and leave them on the sidelines. We need to bring them in to society, offer them treatment, and once again neutralise the toxic social threat that they offer as criminals, because they have to fund their habit. Or even if it's a legal drug like alcohol, they're clattering into things, driving drugs. We need to offer them treatment and activate them and incorporate them into our society. So the message is ultimately one of pragmatism, altruism and compassion in all areas of the condition.
That's well said. Here's my concern. My concern is that I do not trust this administration to look at the addicted person as anything other than another income stream for Big Pharma. Because once you take them off the drug, the hard drug, and you start putting them on many of the anti-anxiety drugs, these create suicide and suicidal ideation. They have to stay on them forever. It's very hard to get off these drugs to withdraw unless you have a very knowledgeable person that can help you in that process. And it's just Big Pharma writing the policies, just like big insurance companies wrote Obamacare. It wasn't to help more people get better quality care. That has not happened. It's you're getting the care that insurance companies want you to get, and if they don't want you to get, they don't allow it. But they're making their profit no matter what. About 33% of all the money spent they get directly, the insurance companies. Well, hey, that pays for the private jets, for the corporate councils and leaders, that pays for the big bonuses, because you're dealing with a $3.5 trillion annual budget and they're getting over $1 trillion in profit. This would just be another income stream. How do I know how to help people? Because for decades. I worked at the Institute of Applied Biology, and across the street was Trafalgar Hospital and the drug program there. They were using methadone until the drug director saw that I was able to help people using nutrition approaches, intravenous vitamins, certain niacinamide and non-flush methods of getting them off the addictive substance, whether it was methamphetamines or crack and heroin, to where they had to have no medications. They were normal with lots of psycho-counseling, psychotherapy. That's why I'm a major supporter of humanistic counseling, whether it's from a psychologist or psychotherapist or psychoanalyst or a psychiatrist. But the pharmaceutical approach doesn't work, and they're just being unrealistic. Also, I don't trust them because at the same time that they're mouthing something that would seem good, he could, by executive order, stop the war on drugs. He could say, stop arresting all people using marijuana. We still have a national law against marijuana. The states are making some changes, but not the federal government. And also, he could allow all the people in prison for marijuana use out, and he could expunge a record. He could do that by executive order. He has chosen not to. So look carefully. We should not have, what we should have, in my personal opinion, is in every single community in America. And by the way, you have more drug addicts in Utah, you know, with its Mormon-based population, and suicide than almost any other group per population in the United States. So the big drug addiction is not always where you think it is. But we should have counseling, actual houses where people can come. You can get government buildings. There is 10 million square feet in New York City alone. And you can rehab these so that people can stay there. They can get humanistic, holistic therapies, and they can be a safe environment, and they can withdraw under guidance, and then they can be rehabilitated so they can reenter society. We could have psychologists, social workers, therapists, nutritionists, career counselors, family counselors. All of these are needed. Could you imagine then how many quality care facilities we could have, and how many millions of people could be benefited, and then how many families would no longer be estranged or ruined, how many lives destroyed? But behind all that, you have the for-private prison system that is driving also the war on drugs, because when you commit a crime, you go to their jail, they make a profit. So if you stop the war on drugs, at least 50% of the people wouldn't be in jail. And also you would stop all the massive narco-terrorism in Central and South America and Mexico, which are completely controlled. Every single country is influenced at every level by drugs. Now, for those who feel that there have not been black voices speaking out against the utter corruption and the moral bankruptcy of a Clinton, remember, you elect one, you get two. That's not a good twofer. It's not like a Broadway show. Buy one ticket, two people can come, because you have to look honestly at their record. And now we're only speaking about how the Clintons, in 8 years in office, impacted the black Americans. Let's hear from a black who's talking about Clinton and what she did to other blacks.
How many of you voting for Hillary? You don't have to raise your hands. I do not blame you for wanting a female president. But that's a wicked woman. Now, listen, you can vote for her, but vote for her with knowledge. She can be sweet, but so can you. And you know when you're sweet but playing a game. All of a sudden, she know about Trayvon Martin. All of a sudden, the boy been dead nearly 2 years. Now she's talking about him like she met the mother and, oh, white people, this is Satan. And you fall for that crap? Most of you that went to jail for having a little blunt in your pocket, they arranged that, the Clintons. Mass incarceration came about under the Clintons. Don't forget that. They call my young gangbangers super predators. And Black Lives Matter put it to her. She didn't know how to handle that. Call you a super predator that has no conscience, no sensitivity, like you a dog, you an animal. We gotta bring you to heel. You, my young brothers, this is what she said about you. And she didn't just say it. It became law and policy of the U.S. government under Bill Clinton and her wife, his wife. And now she's apologizing. But apologizing can't bring back the broken families. Apologizing can't bring back those that have been destroyed in prison life. Apologizing! All the refugees fleeing out of Syria, fleeing out of Libya, fleeing out of North Africa is because of policies of the government of the United States of America and her, specifically. Now, when they release all those emails that they haven't released yet, it'll show you how she maneuvered our president.
Okay. There's someone telling the truth about Hillary Clinton. Why can't the nation, Mother Jones and others, say the same thing, even with less passion? But his passion is there to remind us that millions upon millions of people have suffered because of those two caricatures of human beings. Back in a moment, please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Have you noticed how many kids have been diagnosed with ADD or ADHD or on meds, sometimes for years upon years? Well, these kids are normal kids more often than not. And there's a lot of circumstances, not just one factor. Waking up in the morning when you have not had a good night's sleep. Your brain is overstimulated with electromagnetic pulse damage for the chromosomes from the cell phones and computers. Frequently, kids actually sleep with their cell phones under their pillows. Then you have the caffeine that is considered normal now, 500, 700 milligrams some kids take a day. Then you also have the sugar. You have the improper diets of most kids, lots of fast foods. And then you have an understimulating classroom and yet an overstimulating world around them, so they don't pay a lot of attention. You have some very good teachers, and you have some very boring teachers. And I was once speaking with a child. I had a health support group of only kids and their parents with ADD and ADHD who were on meds. And the very first question I asked, mind you, all these kids have been diagnosed, they were all on meds, and I said, how many of you have teachers you like? Some hands went up. How many stay focused in their room and do well on studying and testing? Again. And then I said, how many of you find some teachers who are just boring or the subject matter is not interesting, so you don't pay attention, so you don't do well? Again, people agreed. How many of you can keep your focus on projects outside of class that you're interested in, hobbies or something that excites you? Hands went up. I said, well, let me explain what you just told me. You told me that you have the most unique disease in history, one that if you're bored, comes on, and one if you're excited, turns off. Could you imagine if it wasn't ADD and mental disease that we're talking about, but rather cancer? One day you got pancreatic cancer that's killing you, but the next day you're doing something you like, and you have no cancer at all in your body. And then you get into a bad mood and you have cancer of the brain, but the next day you have no cancer at all because you're happy. It doesn't work that way. Disease is not episodic based upon your emotion. You either have a condition of brain chemical imbalance or you don't, and there's no science showing a brain chemical imbalance exists. The only thing we've done with our kids is we've made it easier for big pharmaceutical companies to create and patent drugs to treat these illusionary conditions like social anxiety disorder and math defiance disorder and parental defiance disorder. None of these are real. These are just normal kids. This is from Psychology Today, which continues to do some outstanding articles. This is by Dr. Marilyn Wedge. Quote, the ADHD culture, a Machiavellian tale. Why so many children are diagnosed with ADHD. Today, 1 in 8 American children is diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In 1987, when ADHD made its debut in the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic Manual, DSM-3, the authors estimated that 1 in 33 children had the condition. This number included children with known central nervous system disorders like cerebral palsy, encephalitis, epilepsy, diseases that were known to cause hyperactivity in children. Before 1980, the drugging of children with amphetamines on a massive scale was unheard of, even unimaginable. What most people could not envision, however, was within just a short period of time, marketing departments of drug companies would kick into gear. In the 1930s, the company Smith, Kline & French, now GlaxoSmithKline, had manufactured an amphetamine called benzedrine, though first marketed as in an inhaler for nasal congestion. Benzedrine became known for its capacity to enhance focus. Pediatric neurologist Charles Bradley found that benzedrine helped children with encephalitis and other well-known actual neurological disorders to focus on their schoolwork. Bradley insisted, however, that if the cause of a child's inability to focus was emotional stress, like trauma, or chaotic home life, then the preferred treatment was psychotherapy, which is talk therapy, no drugs. Smith, Kline, and French, however, saw in benzedrine a golden opportunity. Why not convince doctors that healthy children whose hyperactivity and inattentiveness originated in emotional stress could benefit from this new amphetamine? Other drug companies soon saw the market potential for drugs. Novartis had one. Ritalin was licensed in 1955. And doctors began prescribing it for overactive children in the 1960s. Shire's Adderall was approved in the 1990s and has enjoyed enormous success, though Adderall carries this black spot warning. Potential for abuse. Amphetamines have a high potential for abuse. Prolonged administration may lead to dependency. Misuse of amphetamines can cause sudden death and serious cardiovascular adverse reactions. By the 1970s, pharmaceutical companies had become a powerhouse in American psychiatry. Companies provided substantial backing for research and contributed to the funding of the American Psychiatric Association's conventions. Drug companies wowed child psychiatrists by offering them huge speaking and consulting fees. They also offered doctors opportunities to publish in prestigious journals, though many of the articles bearing the doctors' names were actually ghostwritten by marketing departments of pharmaceutical companies. By 1994, drug companies had achieved astonishing success with the profession of the American Psychiatry. The American Psychiatric Association's fourth edition of their diagnostic manual, DSM-IV, published in that year, was designed in large part by psychiatrists who had financial ties to drug companies. With the help of the industry, psychiatry transformed itself from the art of healing, which was non-pharmaceutical, to the craft of arriving at a diagnosis, preferably one for which there was a ready-to-hand drug to suppress symptoms. Diagnostic Statistical Manual authors frame children's hyperactivity and inattentiveness as symptoms of a biological disorder for which the preferred treatment was stimulant drugs. Yet despite billions of dollars of drug company research funding for over a half a century, not a single biological cause of ADHD has ever been discovered. No genetic cause for hyperactivity or inattentive behavior has been identified. Today, prominent psychiatrists, including the lead author of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual 4, admit that the notion of ADHD is caused by defective brain chemistry is a myth, without any basis in science. And as I explained in depth in A Disease Called Childhood, researchers who claimed they had found a genetic link to ADHD-type behaviors are now saying that the child's environment and epigenetics must be given equal weight. Yet the drug industry's success in selling ADHD drugs as a disease requiring drug treatment is unparalleled. Today, millions of schoolchildren take stimulant drugs. Drug companies also sell amphetamines to millions of high school and college students who use them as study drugs. Many of these students obtain the drugs by visiting a psychiatrist's office and having memorized the symptoms of ADHD. They convince the doctor that they need amphetamines. The irony is that this funded research found that giving amphetamines to children would not affect their need for the drugs later in their lives. However, the facts do not bear this out. Millions of young people whose parents gave them stimulants feel that the drugs are acceptable to use, to study, or to simply get high. The consequences of the drug industry selling ADHD as a disorder requiring medication are still playing out in an epidemic of amphetamine addiction among America's youth. Giving stimulant drugs to kids has evolved from Bradley's well-intentioned effort to ease the headaches of his brain-damaged young patients to a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry based upon drugging healthy, normal children who are responding to normal stress. The goal of selling ever more stimulants and the pharmaceutical industry's chokehold on American psychiatry have profoundly reshaped our culture in a way that will not soon be undone. End quote. Now, a couple thoughts. At one point in the 1970s and 80s, many of my friends were psychiatrists and board-certified psychologists. Time and again, especially at the New York Center for Marital Guidance, where Dr. Lang Kahn and I worked helping people, not once was there ever a referral for any drug to a psychiatrist. Not once. And yet, thousands of people would be able to examine the behavior that they or their children were exhibiting and see that there was a reasonable cause for it. Grief is reasonable. It's expected. What is not expected is for someone to arbitrarily say, "You've been grieving for too long. Get over it." And then take them to a psychologist or psychiatrist, and the person gets put onto antidepressive medication. They didn't need that. They needed someone to understand in their individual case, it was taking a little longer for them than otherwise, and many people, to understand the importance of letting go and starting over. In the group of children that I was working with, over 90% improvement occurred within 3 months by giving them a clean diet, getting rid of all the additives and preservatives and sugars and fructose and soft drinks and caffeine, by taking away cell phones and giving them only 1 hour a day, that's 1 hour a day, to computer time, creating a new sense of creative discipline within the house. Meaning, if you wanted a child to eat healthier, then show them a film on how food is made, how it is processed, how the animals are treated. Then take them to farmers' markets and show them healthier ways of buying food. Then have them work with that food by giving them creative recipes, working with the child, until the child can actually make a dish. That established a healthy discipline, being able to show them articles, read articles to them about different times in America's past of how children were expected to act in the presence of adults and older people. There was a respect. And how powerful it was to be able to have older people you could communicate with, where you trusted them. They would be patient with you. They would be understanding. They had a lifetime of experience behind them. So when you might not be able to express yourself to your mother or father, there was always an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent you could, who would be understanding and give you guidance. That's all gone today, with rare exception, and there are some exceptions. Young people today not only don't want to communicate with older people, they don't even like them. There seems to be this common theme in an entire generation that parents are stupid, they're an embarrassment, they're really only there because they can give us what we want at different times. They're a free chauffeur, they're a free cook, they're free room service, they're free and interest-free, don't repay it loan. They do all these things for us, but outside of that, don't pay attention. And a lot of parents have forgotten the lessons of the greatest generation, that without some form of structured discipline, not corporal discipline, but structured, not where you have to yell at a child, but rather you guide the child, that there's a consequence to every action, and there's a moral imperative that you don't do things that will have an adverse effect upon other people simply because it's a whim or it's in a mood that you're in. There's a consequence to your actions if they're negative towards other people. And I think that's very important. And hence, when all these things were put together and they were all included, we had remarkable improvements. Now, if these kids really had brain chemical imbalances, then good parenting, good food, proper sleep, the elimination of electromagnetic pulses going in their brain, the lack of caffeine would have made no difference. If you have a brain chemical imbalance, these are not supposed to impact at all. The fact is they did not have any brain chemical imbalance. As the article showed, with 50 years and billions of dollars spent, they've never found it. Well, it doesn't exist. But we have a problem. We have kids that do not have the proper guidance much of the time. And outside with peers, they have a lot of the wrong input. Separately, a new study shows that psychological distress, but not depression, increase your risk of stroke. That's according to the latest article on this topic. And this was presented by the American Academy of Neurology. Quote, stroke is among the leading causes of long-term disability and death worldwide. This is from the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom. Quote, understanding the mechanisms by which overall emotional health may increase stroke risk may inform stroke prevention and help identify those increased stroke risk. So they researched 20,627 people who had never suffered stroke, and for 8 years they followed them. And what they find is, if you're under a lot of stress, you're more likely to have a stroke. All right? So it's stress, not being able to cope, not being mindful, that causes us a lot of problems. And also, from our environmental segment, there are five islands in the Solomons submerged due to sea level rise. I remember first reporting on this program about 10 years ago, where I said that many of the islands in the Pacific are now sinking. They're being submerged. They're not sinking. They're being overwhelmed by water, and because of the melting of the glaciers and the rise of the sea level. Well, it's now happening at an accelerated rate. Quote from the Digital Journal, aerial and satellite images show rising sea levels have caused five entire islands in the Samoans in the South Pacific to completely disappear. They're gone. The first scientific evidence that confirms the dramatic impact of climate change on low-lying islands. The newly published study by Australian academies using time series aerial and satellite imagery of 33 reef islands from 1947 to 2014 reveals that 11 islands across the northern Solomon Islands have either totally disappeared, they're gone, and or experiencing such severe erosion to the sea levels, they're almost gone. And five islands have vanished completely in a very short period of time. And yet these have been around for at least 300 years and were dense in tropical vegetation. So, again, you can see, why does it matter? Well, because whatever's happening at one place ultimately is going to happen everywhere. It's like last week there was a horrific fire in Canada, and a community, a middle-class, upper-middle-class community of over 82,000 people had to evacuate immediately. They were unprepared. They had not planned for a major fire. Fire destroyed thousands of homes and businesses and has made the place a wasteland now. And so when we don't think of the consequences of global warming, we should, because it's happening. Now, let's hear from Congressman Senator Rand Paul. On this issue, I agree with him. On other issues, I don't. Where he is telling us, hey, once again, the government is taking money from Social Security, our savings. They didn't ask for permission. That's not their money. Remember, Social Security is not an entitlement. The government doesn't give a penny towards Social Security. That's our money. That's our savings. It's there for us. And yet Ronald Reagan borrowed over $2 trillion from it. And they put in an IOU. I believe that the Social Security should be sacred. It's for us. It's not for them. They shouldn't be able to touch it. Here's what he had to say.
In the remaining time, I'd like to talk about a budget point of order that I'm going to be put forward. This legislation does something that many in this body have been critical of in the past. It actually takes money from the obligations to Social Security and transfers them to a more immediate program. Specifically written into the budget rules, though, were rules that say, you know what, if you're going to take money, if you're going to steal money from Social Security, from people who are retired, who have put it in there, and you're going to spend it on something else, that there is a special budget point of order that says, in order to do this, you will need 60 votes. So we will be putting forward a budget resolution that says, do you know what? If you're going to steal money from Social Security, if you're going to take money from Social Security and you're going to spend it on other concerns, people say, oh, well, we're going to spend it on disability. Well, the Social Security Fund was put forward as a pension plan. You have an obligation to those who put the money in. So stealing money from people who will be getting money in the future to pay for immediate concerns is robbing Peter to pay Paul. So those in this body will be asked tonight to vote on whether or not you're willing to vote to take money from Social Security to spend it on immediate concerns. This is sort of like saying, all right, I have a pension fund. Let's say I have $100,000 in my pension plan, but I want to go to the racetrack. And I need some money this week, so I'm willing to take the $100,000 out, and I'm willing to pay a $30,000 penalty, but I'm willing to do it because I am an addict, and I am addicted to spending, and I've got to spend the money now. That's what it is, and you're all guilty of it, right and left. You're going to take money out of the Social Security Fund and you're going to spend it on an immediate fix. And by fix, I mean not fixing the program. By fix, I mean what a junkie does. A junkie is addicted to spending. That's what the problem is here, is that we were addicted to spending. So, Mr. President, at this point, I would like to raise a point of order against the pending motion pursuant to Section 311A of S-Con Res 11, the concurrent resolution on the budget for FY 2016. The legislation reallocates payroll between the retirement and disability programs and therefore breaches the Budget Act. The yeas and nays.
And that is Senator Rand Paul. And think how many times we've been told that that Social Security is a problem. It's not an entitlement. It's not a problem. And had they not taken trillions of dollars out of it to use on projects that more often than not are boondoggles, our government is just out of control. And it's not out of control because it's looking at what we need for good infrastructure, fixing bridges and water mains and helping us to reforest America and cleaning up the Mississippi River. And no, it's not doing any of that. It's using it for all those hundreds of thousands of private contractors who've learned how to game the system, including many former members of the White House and Congress. And we pay for it. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Sky.